I call this meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members and staff and guests of the public, I want to welcome you back to the Minnesota House of Representatives Higher Education Committee. We appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. To ensure that everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. I, the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Bernie, I want to make sure you got that. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles or standing or stretching at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our sergeant-at-arms staff who are identified by wearing the gold ties. Troopers and House security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it, as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal in all of this is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. I will now outline specific procedures for today's hearing, including the order of testimony, any additional requirements unique to this proceeding. And in conclusion, I want to thank everyone for your cooperation and participation in the legislative process. All right, the first item of business for us today is the approval of the minutes from April 10th, 2025. Vice Chair Coulter, have you had the opportunity to review those minutes, and would you be willing to move their approval?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have reviewed the minutes from our April 21st meeting, and I will move those minutes. Those are the minutes I have. I think those are the right ones. Just wanted to clarify that.
Well, that's why you get paid the big bucks to be the vice chair, Mr. Vice Chair. All right. Vice Chair Coulter moves approval of the minutes for April 21st, 2025. Members, is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of Vice Chair Coulter's motion to approve the minutes for April 12th, 2025, please say aye.
Aye.
What's that?
April 21st.
April 21st, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes for April 21st, 2025 are approved. Our next item of business for today is to take a moment to introduce some of our newest members on our higher education team. On the DFL side, we have a new committee legislative assistant, Mr. Carl Yeager. Welcome. We also have new committee pages, Amber Dunham and Nick Johnson. Thank you for getting us all set up. On the GOP side, we have a new committee administrator, Mr. Garrick Spinwin. Welcome. We also have GOP researcher, Jesse McCardle. Welcome. And the GOP committee legislative assistant, Ellie Wasserman. Welcome. All right. We also have new members of our House public information team who is doing work to make sure that our hearing is accessible to Minnesotans all throughout the state. We want to give a very warm welcome to Rachel Mills with House Public Info. Thank you. Okay. Our next order of business is to introduce a report. Members, just a little background on this. Last session, our committee heard from faculty and administrators at Minnesota State about the troubling emerging issue of enrollment fraud in online courses. In response to those concerns, we passed a law to establish a work group at Minnesota State to address this troubling issue. Over the past year, this working group met, gathered information, and has produced the report that we will hear today. In addition to gathering this information, this group has made recommendations to us here at the legislature to help guide our efforts so that no Minnesota students have their state grant access stolen by online fraudsters and criminals. I'm incredibly proud of the budget this committee put together last year, and to have any of those allocated funds misused or stolen is an immense disservice to Minnesota's students and to Minnesota's taxpayers. We're looking forward to hearing today's report, and I look forward to work together this session to protect the investments that have been made by this committee. With that, members, we'll open up with Minnesota State, and then we will hear from the Minnesota State College faculty and the University of Minnesota. Now we will hear a presentation on the Enrollment Fraud Working Group from Minnesota State. First up, I'd like to extend a very warm Higher Education Committee welcome to Craig Munson, the Chief Information Security Officer at Minnesota State, to walk us through the report we all have that should be in your packets. If for some reason they're not, let us know. We'll get those to you. Mr. Munson, welcome to Higher Education. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. My name is Craig Munson. I serve as the Chief Information Security Officer for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And so I oversee the security safeguards for large systems that are used by our 200.
I'm sorry, Mr. Munson. I'm so sorry to cut you off. We want to make sure that everyone is able to hear your testimony. So if you wouldn't mind making sure your microphone is on, and if you could perhaps speak closer in the bit, because we really want to hear what you have to say. Thank you, Mr. Munson.
Okay, how about now? We good? All right. Again, my name is Craig Munson. I am the Chief Information Security Officer for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I oversee the security safeguards for the large systems that are used by our 270,000 students, faculty, and staff. I also worked on the legislative report that we're discussing today. I'd like to let you all know that my testimony will be measured. It may seem like I'm not providing enough detail. Our posture in these conversations is always that fraudsters are listening and learning, and so there may be questions I will be unable to respond to. But before we jump into the report, I'd like to provide some background and context around the types of student fraud that we are seeing and how we are responding. So many of you may have heard of the term ghost student in the past. And what is a ghost student? Well, ghost students are fraudulent enrollments created using stolen or fictitious identities. These fabricated students often are acquired via stolen identities, and they exploit college application systems to illegitimately obtain government aid and other institution services. And why are we seeing this more over the past several years? Well, ghost students have existed for quite some time in higher education. This is not really a new phenomenon. However, ever since the pandemic compelled many higher educational institutions to offer more online classes, this type of enrollment fraud is on the rise. Colleges and universities across the nation have quickly become a primary target for fraudsters who believe that both public and private school systems tend to be much slower in adopting cybersecurity defenses. So what are our risks at Minnesota State? You know, the fraudsters conduct these attacks at scale, often attempting to enroll hundreds and even thousands of students, fake students, at once. If these fake students manage to get enrolled, they then apply for the Pell Grants and other federal college subsidies, stealing money that was intended for real students in need of financial aid. Fraudsters also try to gain access to services, including things like productivity software such as Office 365. They try to gain access to our learning management systems and email systems with the purpose of creating phishing attacks, causing further harm to students, faculty, and staff. So what are we seeing at Minnesota State and our 33 colleges and universities? So we have seen a significant increase in fraud attempts over the last 3 years. During that time, we spent a good amount of time learning the tactics and techniques of the fraudsters. We have implemented a variety of safeguards to mitigate the effects of these fraud attempts. Many of these attacks are coming from places outside of the United States, other countries. Oftentimes, we can talk a little bit about Africa or Asia as being some of the main places we're seeing this. Our analysis shows us that these fraudsters are very well organized and are well financed. They use modern techniques to avoid detection and collectively make tens to hundreds of fraud attempts per day at our colleges and universities. They use productivity tools like regular businesses, and they use AI to automate much of their work. Now, speaking of AI in particular, with the influx and awareness in the use of AI, Fraudsters have access to sophisticated technology tools that assist them in their fraudulent activities. It should be noted, we also leverage AI in our detection and response systems in kind. So how are we protecting ourselves at Minnesota State? This is a phenomenon that will never be 100% remediated as fraudsters continually change tactics. What we focus on is risk mitigation. Minnesota State has been adapting to these attacks for several years now. Over the past 2 years, a cross-functional team has been meeting and are largely doing the things highlighted in this bill. We have been working with our partners in academic and student affairs and their communities of practice. Some of these safeguards are very manual work, with staff members reviewing student applications and validating that this is a real person. Sometimes additional identity proofing steps are required. We are also looking at utilizing validation tools provided by Workday, which for when we implement our new student information system. You may have heard of that previously. I'd like to mention that there are some off-the-shelf solutions that for a long time were not very well suited for student enrollments, as many of these vetting or proofing systems are mainly useful to provide for people who have an established credit profile. So their accuracy degrades for people who are under 25, more so for folks under 21 years of age. And for our PSEO students, our high schoolers who are under 18, this is quite ineffective. Now, I'm happy to report that new off-the-shelf solutions have become available over the last year and are now usable and workable in the higher education space. So our cybersecurity and academic teams are working together to ensure that we do not create equity gaps with our remediation tools, but at the same time, leverage these safeguards effectively to mitigate the attacks. As an open access organization who brings in all, we need to mitigate a balance between accessibility and fraud protections. So that should give us, I would say, a brief history up to where we are today, moving into 2025 and 2026. And with that, the Minnesota State College and University Enrollment Fraud Working Group was convened pursuant to the 2025 session law to develop policies and procedures to prevent fraudulent enrollment in online courses. It is important to note that the technical component of the Fraud Working Group was initially formed a year prior to the legislative request, as risk factors were increasing back then. Once the legislation was passed to establish the working group, Minnesota State briefed the bargaining units and student association leaders on the work of the existing Enrollment Fraud Working Group and invited them to provide feedback and provide perspective and guidance. We see this work as an ongoing effort to mitigate fraud. So we had some key findings as a group. The group established several of them. And the first one was we defined what the scope of the enrollment fraud is, and that was to include fraudulent actions, including falsified records, stolen or fake identities, and financial aid fraud. The term ghost students, which we've heard already today, is defined as stolen or fictitious identities used to enroll in courses primarily to fraudulently access financial aid and institutional technology services. We also acknowledge that this is a rising threat. The pandemic-driven expansion of online learning has increased visibility and frequency of this vulnerability. There are risks to Minnesota State. Large-scale attacks can divert federal aid, compromise IT systems, and erode trust in admissions and financial aid processes. It's also a key finding was we are experiencing an artificial intelligence battleground. Fraudsters leverage AI to enhance their attacks. At the same time, Minnesota State employs AI-driven safeguards to protect us and counteract them. Another key finding is we have implemented protective measures. Minnesota State has implemented business process changes, technical safeguards, and manual identity verification processes to combat this threat. And equity considerations remain central to ensure protections do not create an unreasonable barrier for legitimate students. So next, I'd like to talk about the fraud working group's accomplishments. And so the Fraud Working Group implemented several new initiatives and safeguards to assist with mitigating enrollment fraud. Minnesota State implemented a considerable number of business processes and technical safeguards to strengthen fraud detection over the past year. We made changes in our student information system and identity systems that better track and alert on potential fraudulent student applications. And while I can't go into the specific details, I can say that these safeguards are focused on speeding up those processes and creating early and global alerting capabilities. And by global, what I mean is if something is detected at one college or university, immediately all 33 colleges and universities know about it can respond accordingly. Because our attackers, they don't just do one application. They try and hit as many as they can and all the institutions as often as possible. We also firmed up our identity proofing processes. So when you put your ID out, it is who you say you are, and to ensure that's the reality. Another key accomplishment over the past year was we developed and published something known as the Enrollment Fraud User Guide, which is a comprehensive resource for all colleges, campus, and system office employees. The guide provides standardized protocols to deter fraudulent activities and clear steps for responding to suspected enrollment fraud. It includes how to do account research, identity verification, and communication processes. This is a living document that is updated as the fraudsters change their tactics. And then finally, we identified an opportunity area to further enhance our fraud protections. Our analysis shows automated identity proofing systems represent the most impactful safeguard. Though implementation of this technology would require an additional $1 to $1.5 million annually. This type of system is considered the gold standard in protecting ourselves from student financial aid fraud. So in the report submitted to you, we have also made some recommendations. And based on the findings of the working group, the following recommendations are offered to strengthen the ability of Minnesota State colleges and universities to prevent and mitigate enrollment fraud. First and foremost is the investment in an automated identity proofing system. These systems have matured to a point of being adaptable and usable by our diverse student population, providing equitable access to younger students and those without established credit histories. Those funds would be used to acquire, implement, and maintain an automated identity proofing system across all 33 of Minnesota State colleges and universities. And again, the estimated annual cost was $1 to $1.5 million for it would include acquisition, implementation, support, and maintenance of a typical system. An automated identity proofing system will dramatically speed up and expand on the manual identity proofing processes that we're already doing today. This would result in more accurate detection capabilities, and implementing a system that runs at near real-time speed will provide targeted, advanced, and timely alerting to colleges and universities. And that's critical in mitigating financial aid fraud. An automated identity proofing system is more flexible than manual processes, allowing us to rapidly react to the ever-changing attack patterns and techniques the fraudsters throw at us every day. And the next recommendation is on ongoing legislative oversight. And this would be to require annual reporting to the legislature on enrollment fraud trends and mitigation efforts and system performance and how things are generally going. This would ensure transparency in how funds are used to strengthen fraud detection and prevention. Another recommendation is the expansion of cross-functional collaboration. And what we're talking about here is expand the collaboration between Minnesota State's academic and student affairs teams with my own cybersecurity team. In essence, this would formalize the fraud working group as a standing committee to monitor evolving threats and recommend timely safeguards. We also have a recommendation in enhanced training and awareness. So as fraud tactics evolve, we need to continue to provide training for admissions, financial aid, and IT staff on fraud detection techniques. This has been started with that publication of the Student Fraud User Guide I mentioned previously, but it would also include the provision to develop awareness campaigns for students to recognize phishing attempts and fraudulent services that they can be exposed to. Our recommendation is also to continue the partnership between the federal and state education entities, and that would be to continue to collaborate with federal agencies such as the Department of Education and the FBI to share intelligence on fraud trends. We believe that we should advocate for federal support in developing student-focused identity verification tools that account for student populations at the national level. I'd like to note that we've been in direct contact with the Federal Department of Education, and we've provided input on how a national identity proofing system would impact our students at Minnesota State. Now, they have had discussions in the past about implementing. To date, we have not seen any activity in that space. Another recommendation we have is we still need to ensure that we do equity-centered safeguards, ensure that fraud prevention measures do not create barriers for legitimate applicants, particularly those underrepresented groups. So in that space, we would conduct equity impact assessments before implementing any new safeguards. So we need to do our homework first before implementing a new technology, process, or system, and then learn later how it affected our students. We need to do that up front. And then our last recommendation is the institutional adoption of that enrollment fraud user guide and ensure that continued system-wide adoption was created by the fraud working group and require all 33 institutions to integrate the guide's standardized protocols into admissions, financial aid, and IT practices. Now, we are committed to provide ongoing updates to that guide, as I had mentioned, as fraud tactics change and evolve, ensuring it remains a living resources for staff training and operational response. So wrapping things up in conclusion, enrollment fraud, particularly the rise of ghost students, represents a persistent and evolving challenge for Minnesota State colleges and universities. And while significant progress has been made through business process changes, technical safeguards, and collaborative efforts, continued investment and vigilance are essential. The working group, again, recommends prioritizing the implementation of an automated identity proofing system, strengthening cross-functional collaboration, and maintaining equity-centered safeguards. Additionally, the enrollment fraud user guide should be formally adopted system-wide to ensure consistent, standardized response to fraud across all campuses. Legislative support and funding, oversight, and partnership will be crucial to ensure Minnesota State can protect taxpayer resources, uphold institutional integrity, and provide assurance that legitimate students receive the financial aid and the services they need to succeed. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on this topic. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Munson, thank you so much for that insightful testimony. Members, are there any questions? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. And for the record, when I came, my colleague's spots were filled. That's why I'm sitting on the side of the table today.
Hey, if you want to switch, we'd be happy to have you, Representative
Nice to
Robbins.
See you all.
Yeah, that would actually make things a lot easier. No.
I thought you wanted to hang out with us.
I'm not sure why their spots were filled, so I don't know what's going on. But anyway, welcome to the committee. I read your report. I don't see a number for the number of ghost systems in this system.
Number of ghost
Mr.
students.
Mr. Munson.
Oh, sorry. Number of ghost students. You were asking, yeah, we have ghost students in our systems. We remediate them as quickly as possible. I can't give you specifics, you know, in a public testimony on the numbers because our fraudsters are also listening in, and then they do different campaigns to say, well, we tried it this way or we tried it that way, and so we don't want to kind of tip them off on what's effective and what's not, but I'd be happy to talk to you offline on that.
Yes.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair. I do think it's important for the public. I don't think it tips them off if you give us an aggregate number, not broken down by different categories or even necessarily by each institution, but understanding the scope of the problem and how it's changed from, say, 2019 to the present. Is it accelerating? Those numbers matter, so please.
Mr. Munson.
Yes, Representative Robbins. What I can say is it has increased since 2019 for the reasons I gave previously. The number is in the thousands that we detect. That doesn't mean that we have 1,000 that are getting through. It's kind of like goalie, and you kind of stop a lot of the shots on goal. We have some that make it through.
Last Representative week. Robbins.
Thank you. So if you could follow up with me with the number of attempts, the number that make it through, and then what it's costing. Like, how much do those GO students siphon out of Pell Grant, state grant, all of that? Thank you.
Mr. Munson.
Thank you. And yes, we can provide that offline. What I can say is we met with other colleges and universities at the national level. And in looking where we are at versus other large systems like California or Virginia or over in New York, we are a little bit ahead of the curve from where they're at, but we still have work to go.
All righty. Further member discussion going down our list. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, this I don't know if this is necessarily a question for Mr. Munson, but I just the user guide, has that been implemented throughout the entire MnState system?
Mr. Munson.
Yes, Member Coulter. Yes, we have implemented and shared it with it. The adoption has not been complete yet.
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure what that means exactly. When you say the adoption has not been complete, that means not every school in the MnState system has adopted it?
Mr. Munson.
Yes, thank you. I would say it would be accurate to state that every single practice has not been completely implemented yet because it's been recently published. And so it takes a little bit of time to move it through all 33 colleges and universities.
Okay. Mr. Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my question. Thank you.
All right, further questions for the testifier? Moving down our list, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Munson, you mentioned that you're down at the point where you're making the applicants provide ID. How is that ID being provided, and what ID are you accepting?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you for the question. I don't have all the specifics. Again, I focus more on the technical side, so this would have to be in front of the business. What I can say is typically what happens is it's any state-issued ID is accepted.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Munson, I, like Representative Robbins, would like to get some details on that, if you could do that offline.
Be happy to do that.
Mr. Munson.
Sorry, would be happy to do that.
All right. Anything further, Representative Devani?
I don't think it's going to make any difference what question I asked, Representative.
Okay. Further discussion and questions for the testifier, Representative Cleborne.
Thank you. And Mr. Munson, I appreciate your being with us today, and I understand that you're playing a very serious and difficult game with fraudsters, right? They are whack-a-mole. And while I like that game at the state fair, I don't like it in our computer systems or anything like that, right? I just want to make sure that I heard what you said to Chair Novotny. You said state-issued IDs. Is that correct?
Mr. Munson.
Yes, I believe I said state-issued IDs. I believe federal issued IDs are also acceptable.
Okay, but the government.
Representative Cleborne.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Government IDs is what you're saying.
Yeah, Mr. Munson.
Yeah, yes, Representative Cleborne. Okay. Basically, what we followed was the standard for when you do your I-9, when you're employed or hired, that is the list that we use for establishing a person with those identity forms are acceptable.
Okay. I want to.
Representative Cleborne.
Thank you.
Getting back in the swing of committee.
You would think as a chair, I would know the protocol. So, apology. I also just wanted to take an opportunity to thank you. When the bill was first brought up, I had a lengthy conversation with Minnesota State, and you brought together for me a group of individuals who could explain to me what the system, the educational system, was doing. And I just wanted to thank you. You were way ahead of us as legislators in looking at this. And so I just wanted to commend you for taking the early threats. I think someone said to me, you know, this used to be just about getting Microsoft, right, or software, computer software. And then it has evolved over the decades. Over the years. I just want to thank you for that thorough discussion that we had in 2020. What year are we in? 2025. Mm-hmm. and to encourage my colleagues, if they have further questions, to reach out, because the work that you are doing is substantial, and I'm very appreciative of that, because any dollar that is wasted or is an opportunity for education that our learners do not have. So I really appreciate this. We want to stop this theft, and we want to make sure that the money is going where it needs to go, educating our population. So thank you very much.
All right, further discussion. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. So, yeah, it is indeed infuriating to think that when we allocate the dollars that we have here to go to worthy students in the state of Minnesota, that they are stolen. It is really infuriating. So thank you for the work you're doing. The question I had is kind of about the federal role in this, in helping to stop this fraud. I heard you mention that one of the ways that the resources are being taken is that people are getting Pell Grants to which they are not entitled. And that, I believe, is federal money. And so and I assume that it would be the U.S. Department of Education, which I'm not sure right now what form it exists in still. But, you know, what is the federal partnership with you on trying to stop this fraud?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you for the question, Representative Liebling. Oh, yes, as I said, we did have a conversation with the Federal Department of Education. It sounds like they are very interested in doing something at the national level with our observations on how well are they equipped to do it or how well they are going to enact something. We are waiting. We are hopeful, but hope isn't a strategy. And so we have to take matters into our own hands to protect the integrity of our financial aid process.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And so, well, yeah, hope is not a strategy, but, you know, given the amount of rhetoric we do here coming from the federal government about fraud, I really hope that they will be a partner and bring the resources that we need, help us to cut this off, because it certainly sounds like this is the type of threat that is going to continue to grow and change. And I mean, we all know that, you know, internet crime generally, and people are targeted for scams all the time. And so when the fraudsters find some right place to go, they're going to go there. So and I certainly hope we can get the partnership that we need and deserve on this. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Are there any other member questions for Mr. Munson? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Munson, for taking the time to be here. It's not surprising we're talking about fraud once again. It seems to be something that Minnesota's exceptionally well known for anymore. I was just kind of wondering, as you've gone through and done kind of the autopsy of what you're kind of seeing in the vast scale of this whole entire ghost student problem is, can you tell me specifically how many, you don't have to tell me how many numbers, but just tell me how far back this goes, how many years you were able to track students going or people trying to set up bank accounts within Minsku?
Mr. Munson.
Yes, Representative Allen. It went back over a decade. Originally, we had fraudsters that just wanted to have an email address that was connected to a college or university because they were interested in using that for vanity reasons. Then they learned that they could get software discounts if you have a .edu behind your email address, then you can get money off. And then they wanted to sell them on eBay, maybe for $5, and make money that way. Then they wanted to get into our email system so that they could launch phishing attacks and try and impersonate students there. That was probably, I would say, about eight or 7 years ago is what we saw. And then, well, we've all gotten the letters in your mailbox where it says, oh, you've been a victim of identity theft. Your PII was lost. And how could you monetize that? In the last 3-4 years is where we've seen, oh, well, one way is we could pose as a student. And so this causes harm to our citizens of Minnesota and citizens throughout the United States. And the team that I work with, we are very concerned and very I would say, progressive in the sense that we want to stop this in its tracks. So, you know, I work in IT, I work in cybersecurity. We don't want to see a single person to get a single cent that isn't entitled to it. So we're very aggressive in our approach.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up question. With that given, can you give me do you have a rough estimate as far as what is this cost, either the U.S. taxpayer coming out of the state of Minnesota or the Minnesota taxpayer specifically, as far as do you have a rough estimate of about what this is nailing us for at this point, or what it's potentially cost us?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Representative Allen. I don't in front of me. I'm not on the business side for all that. My focus, again, is on the IT. We may be able to get you some offline, a little bit more information on that. When I look at what keeps me up at night, there are other types of attacks that worry me more. Ransomware attacks, phishing attacks cost us more money as an organization than fraud does at this point in time. So I want to accurately characterize, you know, what level of threat are we at? And so I just wanted to lay that out there for you, that it's not the largest thing, that things are falling apart. It is, this is rising a little bit. It used to be number four, number five. It's risen to number three. And that's why we talked about additional help from the legislature in implementing like an identity proofing system so we could bring that down. I want it to be number 10th or 11th as far as severity.
Anything further, Representative Allen?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Munson.
Mr. Munson, I've got a question before we move down the list. Can you offer any insights to juxtapose our issue, both the issues that we're having as well as our methods to address it, and compare that to other states? Are other states experiencing issues with fraud enrollment? And what are other states doing that we can maybe learn from?
I appreciate the question. Yes, we have looked at how do we measure up against other states. I don't want to say that we're doing way better than a lot of the states. We are doing better than some. We look at what happened in other states and what's happened at their large systems, and we look at them. We study them. What have they done? What are we doing different? And we maybe because we were attacked a little bit later, we got kind of the inside scoop on what was happening at the other states, and we were able to put up our defenses a little bit sooner in some cases. Doesn't mean we remediate them all. Again, fraudsters use, you know, 10, 20 different techniques on any given day, and so they're always rotating what they're trying. But if we can stop the vast majority of them, which we are, you know, we always kind of stay a little bit lower on the insight than some of these other ones that got it right away.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this. I hope you can. But can you walk me through the, I guess, application process to a college? I've gone to three separate colleges now, and it's pretty extensive for all of them. And, you know, verifying information and everything. Can you just provide me the kind of high notes of what information you guys are asking for and an application process?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Representative Duran. It's been a while since I've applied myself and walked through it. It's the basic demographic data that we collect. It depends on the type of student that you are and whether it's a two-year or four-year degree, so it gets in a fair amount of details there. They do ask for birth date and some of the general information that you would if you were like applying for a job or something like that. It's similar to that.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would that include like a social security number or any type of verification?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Duran, we have a spot to collect the social security number, but again, we also have international students, a large number of them at some colleges and universities. So there is not always a universal identifier that we have for all students. So we do ask it, but it is optional.
Representative Duran.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that was going to be my next question. How do you verify your foreign students and their identity?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Duran, and I'm not into the deep specifics on that because I'm in IT and not on the business side, but what I can say is they have an international number that they follow and follow up through. So there is it's like a social security number, but it's a different type of identifier that they follow up with.
Representative Duran. Okay, further discussion. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if I have so much of a question. I just want to kind of reflect something back and make sure I'm understanding this correctly. So we've talked a lot about, you know, we've said the word fraud, but I hear you saying cybersecurity. And if you can just, for the sake of the record, confirm, cybersecurity is not the same thing as fraud as it's been defined in the press here in Minnesota. Does that sound accurate to you?
Mr. Munson.
Representative, yes, cybersecurity is, in a simple way, it's keeping attackers out of our systems and out of our networks. Sometimes that can include fraudulent activities.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. It's sort of like institutional hygiene, making sure we're keeping on top of things. And I heard you say that that actually costs more, phishing attempts and things like that. So I think that's helpful information. And I also want to comment on Representative Liebling's question about the federal response. I heard you say that really you're basically not getting a whole lot of help, it doesn't sound like, what I gathered. And I appreciated the chair's question to follow up on that about what other states are doing as well. And I just need to comment that I find it very ironic that in a country with an emoluments clause that's designed to prevent and, like, you know, fraud and corruption by the executive leadership of the nation, that we then have that same federal government not willing to help us address fraud in our state while attacking us for alleged fraud all over the place. So I just wanted to highlight that and make sure we're really clear about how contradicting the messages that we're getting from the federal government are.
Thank you for that, Representative Hansen. Further member discussion, I recognize Representative Hicks.
I just want to say thank you. I have had the pleasure this year of doing 2 financial applications with kids. So it's so fun. So I've got to submit all of the documentation and go through the whole process, not as a business, but as a mom. I've just got a lot of financial aid applications. But I was interested in some of the changes that I saw this year when I was helping with some things. There were some additional pieces that were different. And so I actually went looking, and back in January, there was a story about ghost students. And it was fascinating, and I remember listening to it. And that was nationally. It wasn't Minnesota specific. But the Trump administration's U.S. Department of Education Inspector General said that it was a huge issue and that it's been going on for decades. And he also estimated the overall cost to federal dollars to be $350 million perpetrated in recent schemes. So I think it's pertinent that we were maybe a little bit ahead of that here in Minnesota and already had a working group, which was started by yourselves, you know, before we were aware, you were aware and doing things within your power to try to slow any concerns here in Minnesota. But the focus of the story, as I'm sure you're all aware, was not about government people. The focus of the story was about the students whose lives are destroyed when they suddenly have federal student loans that they didn't even know existed until they get a letter from the IRS telling them they're going to take their tax return or garnish their wages or put a lien on something. And he said it can take years for that to catch up to these victims. And so as we sit around this table, and frankly, apparently a theme this week, all the tables in this building, I want to recenter us back to the victims here, which are these students who don't know that they're students, who have fraudulent loans taken out in their names, who are maxed out on financial aid that they never used, and who don't discover it until they're trying to buy their first house, until they're trying to open a bank account, until they file their taxes in their 20s. So just recentering us back to the people who are the victims of fraudsters, because there are lots of victims when we have fraudsters, one, of course, being taxpayers. But the other victim is the people who funds were intended to help. And over and over and over again, those are the people that are hurt the most, and they're hurt multiple times. And we have got to remember them in these conversations.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Further member discussion, I recognize Vice Chair Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Munson, for your time today. I was wondering if you can help me clarify equity center safeguards.
Mr. Munson.
Yes, Representative Schultz, Schwartz. Sorry. Equity center safeguards. We have different populations that, you know, originally when we looked at identity proofing systems, they would ask hundreds of questions. And so if you were a younger person, for instance, you don't necessarily have a driver's license. You don't necessarily have the IDs that you're looking for. So we needed systems that were adaptable or that you could prove your identity in alternate ways. So some of the new systems, how they've adapted is, well, you can actually show up at an identity proofing location that's in any major city. And so you can show your documents there. So in case you don't have a phone, for instance, or you don't have internet access, you still are able to come as a student into Minnesota State.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any further questions for Mr. Munson?
I do have a follow-up.
Oh,
I apologize.
Vice Chair Schwartz, please continue with your questioning.
Yes, excuse me. With the equity safeguard, you said that because some are minors and they don't have their ID or verification, they have to bring documents. So does that mean that some people do have to provide ID where others don't?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you for the question, Representative Schwartz. Yes, in cases that if we look at an application and let's say that the address of the application ends up to be U.S. Bank Stadium, for instance, mm-hmm. we will escalate it and say we want more types of identification because it's probably not likely that you're living at U.S. Bank Stadium, to give an example.
Representative Schwartz.
So actually used to work at a college when I was younger. For minors, parents would come in and help verify their verification and bring in their information for them and provide all of that information to the school. Do you know, is that still happening or is everything still online? I mean, are you able to follow up on that?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Representative Schwartz. Yes. It depends on whether it's an online course or whether it's in person. If it's in person, there's very little concern or difficulty in proving identity. It's the online coursework that we have, which is pretty frequent in PSEO programs and other programs that we offer at our 33 colleges and universities.
Representative Schwartz.
I know when I was attending school, you do have to come in person to get like a photo ID to verify that it was you. Is that still something that's still in practice today?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Schwartz, yes. And so some of our four-year colleges, it's more common, a little bit less common in our two-year college.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you. That's all I have.
All right. Further questions from members? Representative Robbins.
Thanks. I wanted to follow up on what Vice Chair Schwartz was asking about. So if it's a minor, I'm assuming even if they're PSEO students, they have a driver's license or a high school ID. So you just, is there like a statutory reason you cannot look at those IDs or they, just talk more about that. I was unclear about that.
Mr. Munson.
Representative Robbins. Some of the IDs, like a high school ID, are easily faked. We've seen that multiple times where they're fake. So some things are, you know, the assurance level of each type of identity is different. And so depending on, you know, if it's a minor, oftentimes with our PSEO, they may be even enrolled by the school itself because they've done their own identity proofing processes at the high school. So. Again, depending on the student, depending on the situation, we have to use a variety of ways to ensure that a person is a real person.
Representative Robbins.
So could you require it be a driver's license?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Robbins, I'm on the cybersecurity side. I don't make those policy decisions, but that would be something that would have to be considered by Minnesota State as a whole on what is acceptable and what is not.
Representative Robbins.
And do you know what the current policy is?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Robbins, I don't know in each specific instance on each different type of student that we have.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
Members, are there any further questions for Mr. Munson? I recognize Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if you've covered this because I just got back from appointments and just got here. What sort of internal, within these colleges and universities, what sort of internal controls, if you will, or safeguards are there that help staff catch the fraudsters?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Scott, we have a universal identity system that every single college is tapped into, and it gives a history of where they've applied, what schools they've been to, are they an active student, are they inactive, what their coursework was, basically the complete history of that identity. That's available to all colleges and universities.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you say available to all colleges and universities, do they all use that system, or do you know if they use that system?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Scott, yes, I am aware, and yes, they do use the system.
Okay. And so
Representative Scott.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this is still happening, if we're still getting these ghost students, what needs to be changed internally to prevent it from happening in the future, in your mind?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Scott, I believe we are making very good progress in mitigating that. We are starting to hear declines in the amount of fraud that we're seeing. We see the amount of attempts that are increasing by folks usually outside of the United States. What needs to happen further? I think the best thing that we can do is get an automated identity proofing system that takes out a little bit of the human error, where we have admissions folks who their original job was to welcome students, make sure they're registered correctly and are coming into the right classes. They are acting more like bouncers that have to look at the IDs and look at on the online applications and try and catch them. Having an automated system will do a lot of that behind the background and at speed and at scale.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further member questions? I recognize Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, and I think my question is kind of similar to Representative Scott. You know, I'm wondering, from a legislative perspective, are there any data sharing pieces that you need from us? Are there any kind of withholding provisions, like withholding of payment provisions that you would need from us or OHE would need from us to enable us to stop payment if we believe that there's a ghost student who has already gotten enrolled, or being able to share information either within the institution or outside of the institution while still protecting anyone who might be letting you know of this imposter?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Cleavorn, again, my knowledge on that is only precursory because I center more on the technology side. Mm-hmm. I believe we do have agreements already in place with those entities and those folks over there. So I think we have what we need in that space.
Okay. One follow-up, please.
Chair Cleavorn.
So this morning we had a presentation from Minute in state government, and they were talking about how, you know, we have MN login, right? So I don't know if there's any way that if you are a Minnesota resident and you already have an MN login ID, that would be something that could be transferable. And they use photo recognition, not facial ID, but photo recognition as well. So I'm wondering, are any of those types of policies in place at the institution?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Cleavorn, we are looking at those presently. We do have a close relationship with Minute. In fact, even our own identity system is looking to be integrated with theirs.
Okay.
And so there are some opportunities further down the road. And if we do implement, like I said, an automated system, it also goes to national databases and other sources, multiple sources that would be integrated to that. That would give us a little bit more of an advantage than what we have now.
And the mic.
Representative Cleavorn.
I promise I won't say anything else.
Hey, say what you need to say, Representative.
I just want to make sure that we're balancing the needs for protection, 100% need for protection, but also ensuring that students still have the ability to register and that they don't get so frustrated with all of the what-if pieces that they are denied in education. So it is a delicate balance, and I appreciate the work you do.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Further member questions for Mr. Munson? I recognize Vice Chair Schwartz.
I was just wondering, how quickly are suspicious accounts frozen after a disbursement?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Schwartz, that I do not know the answer to that. Again, that is more on the business side, not on the technology side. We'd have to get back to you on that one.
Okay.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you. I'll be waiting for that information. Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Munson? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Munson, I was just kind of thinking a little bit more here. The 1,000 suspected ghost students that you potentially had, can you say how many of them were actually drawing money from either Pell or from Minnesota grant that's out there?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Allen, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I would say it's a small percentage is what I can say.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be able to say what percentage of that 1,000 potentially was drawing actual dollars out of either federal Pell or the Minnesota grant program?
Mr. Munson.
Representative Allen, I couldn't. I don't have that information, but we would look to get that to you as best we can.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would really appreciate that. I think it would kind of clarify it a little bit more so we can kind of understand the fiscal impact of what this kind of fraud is having on the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Are there any additional member questions for Mr. Munson? All right, seeing none, Mr. Munson, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to testify before our committee today. Thank you. Our next testifier is Mr. Mark Grant, the governmental relations with the Minnesota State College faculty. Mr. Grant, welcome back to the Higher Education. Great to have you back here today with us. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I absolutely will. Thank you, Chair Walgamott. Vice Chairs, it's good to see everybody again. Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Mark Grant. I'm a communication studies faculty member at Dakota County Technical College and currently help with the governmental relations work on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty. I want to start by saying that MSCF is well represented in the work group by Dr. Joe Haker, of Century. He is, unfortunately, Dr. Haker is on sabbatical, and this time just didn't work out for him. So in his absence, I can tell you he's infinitely smarter on this stuff than I am, but I can share with you from a faculty perspective some of the things that we're seeing across the state. First and foremost, our faculty are reporting a significant decline in ghost students. So full stop, that's super cool. Like, that's great. The reduction, significant as it is, doesn't equal zero, though, which kind of brings me to the second point, which is as appreciative faculty are of all the work that's going into making sure that these folks don't end up in our classes. We are still struggling with what to do on a course specific level, what to do when they do in fact slip through. And that leads to conversations that I'm simply not equipped to have. We can have conversations about resources and training and high-end AI detection tools and best practices and all of that kind of stuff. But one of the things our faculty are looking for, honestly, still at this point, is statewide a clear expectation. As faculty, we have a longstanding obligation to report no-shows in the first 10 days of the semester, the goal being to identify folks who just don't show up before financial aid is dispersed. We also have an obligation to track that attendance and report a last day of attendance after students have been MIA for about 2 weeks. That is longstanding, and that's what we do. But beyond that, we just tell our faculty and have been telling our faculty, if you suspect something, you have to say something. But that's the extent of the guidance that we've been able to give. I think it's important to recognize that from MSCF's perspective, in its current incarnation, MSCF are the ones who brought the presence of ghost students to the attention of Minnesota State College faculty. We had an incredibly in-tune instructor who noticed really weird enrollment patterns in her class, did some deeper diving, contacted us. We turned around, contacted Minnesota State. Have you ever heard of this? The answer was, nope, this is new to me. Now, on the cyber side, they may have been matrixing this thing a long time ago, but from the leadership standpoint at MSC or at Minnesota State, we let them know that. I bring this up because we believe that expectations still haven't been super clearly defined. If expectations of faculty extend beyond our current reporting obligations, then somebody needs to tell us that. Because absent that direction, we have faculty who are still employing a number of strategies to combat this, including requiring scheduled Zoom meetings to verify the veracity of a student. But when you've got 5 online sections with 40 students apiece, that is 200 Zoom meetings. That is, it becomes, administratively, it just becomes burdensome when you add on top of that class prep, teaching, grading, advising. Our fear, of course, is that everybody thinks things are being done, but all those people also think that somebody else is doing that, and then somehow it lands back. Every time something slips through the system, for lack of a better term, every time something isn't done on a system or college level, it lands in our classroom, and our faculty need help with that. What that help is, I wish I could tell you. I know that there are, you know, tools out there. I don't know what they are, and our faculty are loath to become cybersecurity experts simply to conduct the business of doing the class. Having said all of that, we recognize the progress. We recognize that this is an ongoing moving target, and Minnesota State College faculty remain committed to working with Minnesota State and you all to maintain the integrity of our online classrooms. But other than that, I'll be happy to answer any questions I think I might be able to.
Mr. Grant, thank you so much for that testimony. We will now open it up to member questions. Representative Neuer.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Grant, for all the work that your colleagues and everybody is doing to help the state of Minnesota. My question is, if the enrollment for a specific class is closed because you may end up having ghost students who may not even be seeking to acquire the resource, how does that really impact? If a student wants to enroll once your class level has already been reached, how much have you seen of that?
Mr. Grant.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm still getting back into the habit of this as well. Thank you, Representative. In short, I can tell you when this came to our attention via that that perceptive faculty member, that faculty member had seen such a dramatic uptick in enrollment in her courses that additional sections were added. We're not seeing as much of that anymore simply because there has been a decline in those who have slipped through. But there's no doubt that in an attempt to continually meet the needs of our students, that if seats are taken, metaphorically speaking, by students who don't really exist, it could result in an additional section being added, or what's more likely at this point is that a student who needed that class simply gets frozen out of that class.
Anything further, Representative Noor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that extent, so the students who are legitimate who may not be getting the enrollment that they deserve, how do we help them? Because right now, you know, once they're not enrolled in that class, they have to wait for the next semester to be able to enroll. That disrupts even their graduation and everything else. Can you quantify that level of engagement that the faculty has to get involved?
Mr. Grant.
Thank you for that question, Representative. Can I quantify it? No, I really can't. As open access institutions, we work really, really hard to maintain availability and access when our students need it. Now, there's you have to thread a needle between, you know, if we only offered classes when students wanted them, every class would be offered between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. and nobody would ever take a class on Friday. So, you know, you offer the classes when students want them, but understanding also that some students have a fairly tight timeline, and if they can't get this communication class this semester, that pushes them into the summer and extends extends their pursuit for a degree or their educational goals. It may add expense. It's a constant juggling act. It absolutely is. There's an efficient classroom size that most efficiently uses the professor's time and the student's time. We don't hold sections for two students because it's just not a viable way to move forward, but we are constantly trying to measure and adapt to the needs of the students and what's available.
Thank Representative Dorff. Anything further? Okay. Moving down the list, I recognize Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here, Mr. Grant. I feel like I always have to point out when Mr. Grant is here that I am the proud son of a longtime MSCF member. My mom taught at Normandale Community College for many, many years, so grateful for that. I do want to, and I understand you're sort of pinch hitting in this hearing, but you're saying that what I'm hearing you say is that faculty and staff that you are hearing from still feel there's a significant lack of clarity, lack of guidance. And I want to turn to this point of the user guide that was recommended. Am I hearing you correctly say that maybe the question I want to ask is the issue that has not been fully implemented, fully understood? Not that one user guide is going to be the end all and be all, but I'm just sort of curious your thoughts on that generally.
Mr. Grant.
Thank you. Thank you for that question, Representative. I do think the user guide in its totality is focused on the registration end, and the specifics get less and less and less the closer to the classroom that we get. That would be number one. Number two, I think the other two things that you cited are accurate, that it's slow to implement, it's a relatively new document, and so our faculty are still just kind of muddling through. You know, as this gets increasingly more complicated, it's outpacing our faculty's knowledge base and time. Quality of work used to be a hallmark. A student would submit something, and it always sounded like it came from a Nigerian prince who wanted to, you know. And it's simply not that case anymore. It's never good. The work is never good. But as open access institutions, these Go students' work is becoming close enough to the type of the quality and caliber of work that we might expect to see early on in a semester from a student who might really be struggling and who is, maybe college wasn't on their radar and they're back after years or they just didn't think they were going to end up in college. And so it's a difficult dynamic to start out a semester identifying what you think might be a struggling student, and the first item of business is to make them prove that they're a real person. By the way, your work is so questionable that we're not entirely sure you're real. That's an incredibly difficult dynamic to build a relationship with a student, and our faculty are really struggling with that.
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's helpful, and I think to me, and I hope our friends at the Minn State Home Office are listening, that to me that obviously suggests that the user guide is something that needs to be sort of an iterative process, that it's not something that, you know, okay, we did this and now we can dust off our hands and move on. But I think it does sort of, it also suggests to me the importance of the other pieces in the recommendations here, we make too many demands of faculty and staff at our schools to begin with. And asking them to become cybersecurity experts in the process is really not in their job description. And so I think that's where we need to dive into these other pieces, sort of on the front end, and then moving in as far as we can. And then the last thing that I want to say is sort of in a similar vein, I think, to the point that Representative Hicks made. But I think it's not something that we really discuss, is that, you know, the reason I think we are all just so infuriated by all of what we are seeing around this kind of fraud is that it is, of course, the dollars. It's the dollars that aren't going to students that need them, but it's the education that students are now being locked out of. Students that want to get an education and contribute to our state and our economy and our society being unable to do that. and you know, as the son of a community college instructor, that matters immensely to me. And so I'm grateful for the work that's been done and the work that will continue on this. And I think this is also just a really excellent demonstration of how we can tackle this issue in a thoughtful, bipartisan way that focuses on the facts and that gets at the real solutions to these emerging issues. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Vice Chair Coulter. Further member discussion, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for nonpartisan staff, but I'm just wondering, and maybe this was covered before I got here, but I'm just wondering what other states are doing to curb this. Are there some best practices out there that we could take a page from or the entire thing and not have to reinvent the wheel to solve this thing?
Representative Scott, before you got here, Mr. Munson did speak to that.
Oh, he did. I'm sorry. Okay.
But if anyone, Mr. Grant, if you have anything you'd like to add to that, or if Mr. Hopkins or Mr. Savory would like to contribute.
I know. I can't even begin to enumerate the things I don't know about.
Okay, Mr. Hopkins.
Representative Scott, so I can go back and send you the pieces of the testimony from earlier, but there's also the U.S. Department of Education has implemented some new verification procedures around this as well. So there's also federal action.
That's all right. That's what I get for being late to committee. Thank you.
Okay, anything further, Representative Scott? All right, is there any other questions or discussion from members for Mr. Grant? Seeing none, and Mr. Grant, we cannot thank you enough for your testimony. Thank you. Okay, members, wrapping up our presentations, we know that ghost students have been mostly an issue at the MnState system, but we also would like to hear from representatives from the University of Minnesota as well as the Minnesota Private College Council. So with that, I would like to invite both Meredith Fergus and Paul Sergvinnik to the table. Ms. Fergus and Mr. Sergvinnik, I want to give you a warm welcome back to the Higher Education Committee. We appreciate you being here today. If you could, Ms. Fergus, if you could please get us started, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Wolgamott and members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the Financial Aid Analyst for the Office of Undergraduate Education at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm actually filling in for Nate Peterson, our director of the Office of Student Finance, who is unable to join us today. So please save all hard questions for him. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to share information about the University of Minnesota's admissions processes, especially in how we combat enrollment fraud. Due to the Office of Admissions' detailed business processes, we actually are able to weed out suspicious applications early on. We also complete a final verification of confirmed students in the summer prior to them enrolling in the fall and receiving any financial aid. This process is applicable to both new incoming students as well as our transfer students. The first thing is our admissions application requires an application fee be paid or an application fee waiver be completed, which is often a barrier to bots. So it's actually a step that students have to go through. In addition, the admissions staff verify each confirmed student's final high school transcript in the summer to ensure not only that they have graduated from high school, but also kind of confirming that final identity. So students who do not pass this verification have their offer of admissions rescinded and therefore do not receive any financial aid in the fall. I should note that these admissions processes are in addition to the verification that goes on as part of the FAFSA filing process and the financial aid staff. So it's kind of a two-part process. So in terms of our non-degree students are not financial aid eligible, but we do have similar identity verification processes in place. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Paul Sergvinnik.
Ms. Fergus, thank you so much for that testimony. Mr. Sergvinnik, welcome back to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Wolgamott and members of the committee, my name is Paul Sergvinnik. I serve as the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I want to start by saying I don't bring the financial aid expertise of Meredith or the cybersecurity expert of the testimony from Minnesota State. But I was asked to give an overview of my understanding of the experience our institutions have with fraud in financial aid. I will say that some of the things that Meredith just described about the enrollment admissions process at the University of Minnesota is similar to what I understand exists at our institutions. I will just say that so far, our institutions overall have had limited experiences only with financial aid fraud. As you all know, a large share of our programs are in-person and residential programs, and so our financial aid and enrollment staff have direct and in-person engagements with the students who are coming to their institutions very early on in the enrollment process. We had a recent Zoom meeting with our financial aid directors, and one of the topics was financial aid fraud. And on that call, a majority of the institutions indicated they had not experienced any fraud. A small number of our institutions have experienced a limited number of financial aid fraud cases that they're dealing with. And among the things I heard them indicate is that they are all increasing their identity verification procedures because of the increasing threat of financial aid fraud.
Thank you, Mr. Cirkvenik. Members, are there any questions for our testifiers or discussion to the testimony? Representative Hicks.
I just want to say thank you for all the work that you're doing and the different processes. I have gotten the opportunity to apply to lots of Minnesota institutions this year, and the checks that are there are great, and we're not to the end of that yet because we still have to like do all of the stuff next fall, but I've been very impressed with the processes so far. Just as like a mom, I just want to say thanks because it's been really easy to navigate, and I just really appreciate that.
All right, any further questions or discussion? All right, seeing none, Ms. Fergus, Mr. Cirkvenik, we can't thank you enough for your presentation and your testimony. All right, members, there is no further business before the committee. I want to thank all of our members as well as the testifiers for the thoughtful conversation today. We want to make sure that when we invest in programs that support students, that money goes to the students. So thank you for the conversation. There being no further business before our committee, we are adjourned.
Oh, my goodness.